create up to 8,000 new jobs, roughly 10 times as many as the same investment in the coal industry would create. It is no wonder that small businesses are popping up all around the country to do this kind of work. Now, our job is to drive demand by providing incentives for building owners to make the improvements. Energy efficiency truly is a win-win-win in the fight against climate change, in terms of reducing energy use, saving consumers money, and creating jobs. Likewise, transitioning to domestically produced clean energy will create hundreds of thousands of jobs, and if we do it right, stimulate domestic manufacturing. The solar industry is adding workers at a rate nearly 20 times faster than the overall economy. And solar employment has grown by 86% in the past 5 years, adding nearly 80,000 domestic living wage jobs in the manufacture and installation of solar panels. Moreover, the roughly 210,000 Americans currently employed in solar is expected to double by the end of 2020, helping to spur $140 billion in economic activity. And if anyone still doubts that solar power works, my state of Vermont, with its northern, snowy climate, leads the nation in solar jobs per capita, according to the Solar Foundation, a top industry research group. If Vermont can do it, it can be done virtually anywhere in America. Similarly, jobs in the wind energy sector are growing rapidly, with federal incentives attracting more than $100 billion in private investment to the U.S. economy since 2008. According to the U.S. Department of Energy, there are more than 500 wind energy manufacturing facilities of various sizes in the country, and the sector already employs about 50,000 people in manufacturing, installation, and maintenance. Of course, we've just begun to tap the enormous potential of wind energy. In fact, the same DOE report says the wind energy sector could grow to as many as 650,000 jobs by the year 2050. Still, other jobs will be created in an area where the U.S. historically has excelled: technology research and development, affordable electric vehicles and recharging stations, more efficient solar panels, advanced battery systems to store wind and solar energy, and innovative controls to seamlessly integrate renewables into our power grid will all require cutting-edge research. This is the stuff we do so well when challenged as a nation, whether by putting a man on the moon, eradicating diseases, or developing the internet. The U.S. can and must dedicate our engineering know-how to a clean energy revolution in our universities, in our national energy labs, and in businesses and communities all across the country. Of course, there'll be some job displacement as we move away from fossil fuels. When I was in McDowell County, West Virginia, I saw firsthand what happened in terms of poverty and unemployment when the coal industry disappeared. In my view, it is absolutely imperative that workers in those industries do not get left behind, and that they receive the education, training, and access to new jobs that they will need to succeed in a changing economy. These workers must also receive help to maintain wage support, health care, and pensions until they're able to start new jobs. This is not just idle talk. These workers helped power and build this country, and they do some of the most difficult and dangerous jobs in America. We have a national responsibility to make sure that their livelihoods and their families are helped, not hurt, by the transition to clean energy. That is why I introduced the Clean Energy Worker Just Transition Act, to provide comprehensive job training and benefits to workers as they transition to making the solar panels, wind turbines, and batteries of the 21st century. It will also direct resources to the most affected communities, particularly in Appalachian coal country, to clean up the disastrous environmental legacy of coal mining and to build the infrastructure needed to attract new investment and revitalize local economies. Creating jobs by housing families. Another significant challenge that similarly has an upside in terms of creating jobs is addressing the affordable housing crisis in our country. From the time I was elected mayor of Burlington, Vermont in 1981, I have made affordable housing a top priority. And one of my proudest achievements as mayor was creating the first municipally funded community housing trust in the nation. Today, the Champlain Housing Trust that we pioneered in northern Vermont 30 years ago is not only the largest and most successful housing trust in the United States, it is also the model for similar efforts all over the world. As I traveled the country during the campaign, I heard over and over again about the affordable housing crisis that we face as a nation. Public housing in New York City, which houses more people than the entire city of Boston, has a $17 billion maintenance backlog. Yes, that's right, $17 billion. Much of that housing, built decades ago, is now deteriorating, leaving poor and elderly people in unsafe, unhealthy, and substandard high-rise apartments. In San Francisco, Seattle, and elsewhere, I heard about the crisis of gentrification and how working people can no longer afford to remain in the communities they lived in for their entire lives and they want to stay in. In rural areas, low-income people are paying outrageously high prices and fuel bills living in trailer parks, while most homes, especially homes of decent quality, appreciate over the years. This is not the case with mobile homes. They deteriorate in value. While the ownership of housing is often a means of increasing wealth for the middle class, it is often the very opposite for poor people in rural areas. When I was a kid, the expectation was that no family should spend more than 25% of its income on housing. My family, which lived in a rent-controlled apartment in Brooklyn, spent a much smaller percentage than that. According to the National Low Income Housing Coalition, NLIHC, that reality has changed. Today, more than a quarter of the nation's 43.2 million renter households are severely rent burdened, using more than half their income to pay rent. Of course, the situation is direst for families with the lowest incomes, with 6.6 million families below the poverty line paying at least half of their very limited incomes just to put a roof over their heads, leaving precious little for other necessities like food, healthcare, and transportation. NLIHC calculates that the nation faces an immediate shortage of 7.2 million affordable apartments for extremely low-income families. Meanwhile, more than half a million people, families with children, veterans, the mentally ill, and runaway youth, are living in their cars, in homeless shelters, or on the streets. Access to safe, decent, and affordable housing is critically important for families in healthy communities. Study after study has shown that without stable housing, it is much harder for working people to hold down jobs and get the health care they need. And children are put at a profound disadvantage in terms of intellectual and emotional development and school performance. That very idea that everyone has equal opportunity to succeed evaporates in the absence of stable and affordable housing. We have to level the playing field. We have to build millions of units of affordable housing. In 2001, I authored and then helped lead a 15-year effort to pass and secure funding for the National Housing Trust Fund, the first new federal housing construction program in almost three decades, and the first ever aimed at building affordable rental housing for extremely low-income households. While the Obama administration has begun to fund the program, the level of funding is totally inadequate. We should fund the NHTF at no less than $5 billion every year over at least a decade. Decent quality, affordable housing should be a right of all Americans. This is important in order for family members to have good relationships with one another, that kids grow up in a healthy environment, and that seniors be able to retire with security and dignity. Clearly, that is not what we see today. We need to create millions of units of affordable housing in larger cities, in smaller towns, and in almost every part of the country. And when we do that, we also create jobs, a whole lot of good-paying jobs, construction jobs, service jobs, and jobs in building materials and supply businesses. Jobs we need. creating childcare and preschool jobs. When I talk about rebuilding America, I'm not just talking about our physical infrastructure, about bricks and mortar, as important as that is. I also mean our human infrastructure and meeting the needs of some of the most vulnerable people in our country. The truth is that as a nation, we do a disgraceful job in providing for our children. We not only have the highest rate of childhood poverty of almost any major nation on earth, but we have a dysfunctional childcare and pre-K system that has completely ignored the radical changes that have taken place in our economy over the last 40 years. In my view, there's no more important job in America than taking care of, nurturing, and educating our youngest children. Today's infants, toddlers, and preschoolers are the future of our country. They have the potential to grow up to be our future doctors, nurses, scientists, engineers, astronauts, farmers, and political leaders. But without the right kind of education, love, and nourishment, particularly at a young age, they also have the potential to become drug dealers, criminals, and people who engage in self-destructive activities that will land them in jail and/or a life of poverty. Every psychologist who has studied this issue agrees that the most formative years of a human being's life are from 0 to 4. In fact, according to the most recent research, approximately 90% of brain development occurs before the age of 5. Yet we have millions of young children who are in inadequate childcare facilities with adults who lack the training and expertise to effectively nurture them. And it says a lot about our attitude toward young children when many of our childcare workers earn the minimum wage with minimal benefits. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the average childcare worker in 2015 had only a high school diploma, received a short-term on-the-job training, and made just $9.70 an hour, less than a typical parking lot attendant or janitor. At a time when nearly 60% of women are now in the workforce, we need a revolution in this country in terms of how we provide childcare and pre-K education. The bottom line is that we have got to make sure every family in America has the opportunity to send their kids to a high-quality childcare and pre-K program. We must invest in our young people today because by doing so, we invest in the potential of our nation. And by making high-quality childcare a priority and enacting other family-friendly policies, we could allow an additional 5.5 million women to enter the workforce and generate some $500 billion a year in economic growth, about 3.5% of gross domestic product. According to the most recent federal study, only 10% of our nation's childcare programs are considered to be of high quality. Too many childcare facilities and preschools are run down. They're not open long enough to meet the demands of parents who work the late shift or odd hours. They do not provide for the nutritional needs of children. They don't provide healthcare services to kids who get sick. They don't have the ability to take care of kids with disabilities or special needs, and too many of them are often staffed with poorly trained and poorly paid workers. For the future of America and for the long-term health of our economy, we must recognize that providing high-quality childcare and pre-K programs costs a hell of a lot less than locking up young adults later in life because they were neglected when they were toddlers, got a bad start in school, and got into trouble as they grew up. The childcare crisis in this country is something that's far too rarely discussed. But it is something that must be addressed, and addressed now. And when we do, we will not only improve the lives of our youngest children, we will create millions of jobs and improve the economy now and into the future. This is not just my opinion. According to a 2007 report by the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis, the most efficient means to boost the productivity of the workforce 15 to 20 years down the road is to invest in today's youngest children. Research shows that investments in high-quality early education appear to reduce future crime and are more cost-effective than additional spending on police or incarceration. We don't pretend to have all the answers to economic development. but we're quite certain that investing in early childhood education is more likely to create a vibrant economy than using public funds to lure a sports team by building a new stadium or attracting an automaker by providing tax breaks. Unfortunately, compared with other countries, the U.S. ranks near the bottom when it comes to spending on childcare and preschool. Unlike the U.S., dozens of countries around the world have recognized the importance of investing in early care and education. Across the member nations of the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, 84% of four-year-olds are enrolled in early education versus just 69% in the U.S. Moreover, just 51% of three-year-olds in the U.S. are enrolled in publicly funded early education compared with more than 90% in the United Kingdom, Germany, Belgium, Denmark, Iceland, Norway, Spain, and Sweden. Even poorer countries like Slovenia, Argentina, Hungary, Mexico, Chile, and Poland invest more of their GDP in childcare and preschool than we do. We got to do a lot better than that. How do we get there? First, we've got to make childcare and preschool affordable and available to all. The best childcare centers and preschools in America are simply out of reach for most families. Today, it costs an average of about $18,000 a year to provide an infant with high-quality childcare in America. That's $3,000 more than a full-time minimum wage worker makes. In most states, childcare costs more than a college education and the average rent. And 85% of children who are eligible to receive childcare assistance don't get the care they need because of a lack of funding. In my view, we need to provide free, full-day, high-quality childcare from infancy to age 3 for the 75% of families making $100,000 a year or less. For families making between $100,000 and $150,000, we need to cap childcare expenses at no more than 10% of income. And we need to make sure that every child starting at age 3 will be guaranteed a pre-kindergarten education regardless of family income. By making this investment, we will provide over 16 million children with the financial assistance they need to enroll in childcare and preschool programs in America, up from 1.5 million today. And in the process, we will double the number of early childhood educators in this country from about 1.3 million today to more than 2.6 million. Second, we've got to make sure that every childcare and preschool facility in America provides high-quality care. That means substantially smaller class sizes. It means offering care at least 10 hours a day to meet the needs of parents who work non-traditional hours. It means providing children with healthy and nutritious meals, making sure they have access to health and wellness services, and hiring experts to provide care to kids with disabilities and special needs. Moreover, improving the quality of childcare means requiring childcare workers and preschool teachers to have the appropriate level of education and training. At a minimum, all childcare workers should have a Child Development Associate, CDA, credential. All caregivers should have an associate degree, and all preschool teachers should have a bachelor's degree. These enhanced educational requirements will increase the quality of childcare and preschool programs and will also create new jobs on college campuses and early childhood education. And it means paying childcare workers and preschool teachers a living wage. Childcare workers should be paid a minimum of $15 an hour, and preschool teachers should be paid no less than similarly qualified kindergarten teachers. Today, the typical kindergarten teacher makes almost twice as much as a preschool teacher. It's time to end that arbitrary disparity. Greatly expanded access for early care and education also means that children will need new learning environments that they can thrive in. The American Academy of Pediatrics, AAP, and the American Public Health Association, APHA, have recommended that each child in a high-quality facility should have at least 75 square feet of indoor space. Based on these recommendations, we would need to construct, renovate, or rehabilitate over 180,000 child care facilities and preschools throughout the country, creating an additional 1.1 million new construction jobs in the process. The U.S. actually had universal child care from 1943 to 1946, when child care was virtually free. During those years, more than 100,000 children from families of all incomes received the care they needed, which allowed women to enter the workplace at a time when men were leaving in droves to fight in the war. In the 1940s, universal child care was considered a national security priority. In the 21st century, when having both parents in the workforce is an economic necessity for the vast majority of families, we need affordable, high-quality child care more than ever. Taking good care of the youngest children in America and allowing parents to access high-quality, affordable child care will have a profound impact on the future of our country. It will enable millions of children to be better prepared for school, bring more women into the workforce, and make our economy much more productive. It will also create millions of good-paying jobs as a bonus. Turning workers into owners. While we create millions of good-paying jobs, rebuilding our physical and human infrastructure, and transforming our country, there's another economic step forward that we must take. We need to take a hard look at new business ownership models in the country. To my mind, we need to significantly expand employee ownership. Over the last 15 years, large multinational corporations have shut down some 60,000 factories in America and moved millions of decent-paying jobs abroad in search of cheap labor. The only thing that matters to these corporations are short-term profits, strong dividends, and high compensation packages for the CEOs. What happens to the employees? What happens to the environment? What happens to the community in which they function matters very little. These are not American companies. They're companies currently located in America. Tomorrow, if the economics made sense to them, they could be located in China. Their only allegiance is to the bottom line. It is time as a nation that we stop worshiping corporate greed and businessmen like Jack Welch, the former head of General Electric, while in corporate circles and in the corporate media, Jack Welch is regarded as a brilliant and successful businessman. The truth is that he represents almost everything that is wrong with contemporary capitalism. As the CEO of General Electric, Welch moved dozens of GE factories abroad, outsourced hundreds of thousands of jobs, and slashed benefits for many of his employees. To add insult to injury, after destroying the retirement dreams of so many of his workers, he received a $400 million golden parachute for himself. This type of greed and ruthless capitalism is not an economic model we should be embracing. We can do better. We must do better. The economic establishment tells us that there is no alternative to this type of rapacious cutthroat capitalism, and that this is how the system and globalization works, and that there's no turning back. They're dead wrong. The truth is that we can and we must develop new economic models to create jobs and increase wages and productivity. Instead of giving huge tax breaks to corporations that ship our jobs to China and other low-wage countries, we need to provide assistance to workers who want to purchase their own businesses by establishing worker-owned cooperatives and majority-owned employee stock ownership plans, ESOPs. Study after study has shown that employee ownership increases employment, increases productivity, increases sales, and increases wages in the United States. In fact, according to a survey by Georgetown University and American University, during the Great Recession in 2008, while corporations were slashing jobs, employee-owned firms increased jobs by 2%. Amazingly, while the construction industry slashed 10% of its jobs in 2008 after the housing market collapsed, many worker-owned construction firms actually added jobs. Unlike large corporations that have been shipping jobs overseas, employee-owned businesses, by and large, are not shutting down and moving their businesses to China, Bangladesh, or other low-wage countries. Further, Employee-owned businesses boost morale because workers share in profits and have more control over their work lives. The employees are not simply cogs in a machine owned by someone else. They have a say in how the company is run. One of the great things about living in Vermont is that you don't need a study to understand the benefits of employee ownership. All you need to do is ask the worker owners at Chroma Technology in Bellows Falls, Gardner Supply in Burlington, King Arthur Flour in Norwich, or Karis Reels in Rutland. I have had the honor of meeting with many of these employees. Never in my life have I seen workers who have more pride in their work than they do. From senior executives and managers all the way down to the cashier and the store clerk, today, there are more than 36 worker-owned companies in Vermont. And Vermont is certainly not alone. Nationally, there are about 7,000 worker-owned businesses throughout the country with over 14 million employees. In New York City, Cooperative Home Care Associates in the Bronx is the nation's largest worker-owned cooperative, employing over 2,000 people, largely African-American and Latin American women. This company has a turnover rate of just 15%, far less than the prevailing rates of 40 to 60% for the rest of the home care industry. Job stability for the cooperative's worker owners translates into better care for the clients who depend on them. In Cleveland, the Evergreen Cooperatives, a network of worker-owned businesses created in conjunction with local universities and hospitals, is creating living wage jobs for residents of neighborhoods that have suffered from decades of disinvestment. In Oakland, California, a group of black women opened the Mandela Food Cooperative as a worker-owned solution to the lack of healthy food in their community. In Morganton, North Carolina, the worker-owned Opportunity Threads Cooperative is a leading force in revitalizing a local textile industry decimated by globalization. The workers in these operations understand that when employees own their companies, when they work for themselves, when they're involved in the decision-making that impacts their jobs, they're no longer just punching a time clock. They become more motivated. Absenteeism goes down, worker productivity goes up, and people stay on the job for a longer period of time. And these ventures don't need to be small, niche companies. The 74,000 employees at Mondragon Cooperatives in Spain is a model for worker ownership worldwide. At a time when the rest of Spain continues to experience a serious recession, the worker-owned businesses of Mondragon have been able to manage the economic crisis exceptionally well. And the executives of these worker cooperatives cannot make more than 8 times as much as their average worker. CEOs in the U.S. earn nearly 300 times as much as their average employee. Unfortunately, despite the important role that worker ownership can play in revitalizing our economy, the federal government has failed to commit to the resources needed to allow employee ownership to realize its true potential. During the next Congress, I'll be introducing a bill to create a U.S. employee ownership bank to provide low-interest loans, grants, and technical assistance to help workers purchase businesses through a majority-owned employee stock ownership plan or a worker-owned cooperative. I will also be introducing a bill to establish and expand employee ownership centers that provide training and technical support to promote employee ownership and participation throughout the country. By providing low-interest federal loans, by educating business owners and employees about the benefits of worker ownership, and by providing them with the tools to succeed, we can allow the employee ownership model to realize its true potential and create and save millions of jobs in the process. There are also other opportunities to encourage worker ownership of businesses. As thousands of baby boomer business owners begin to plan for retirement, existing federal law provides tax benefits to retiring owners who sell to their workers. With federal assistance, an estimated 150,000 to 300,000 small and medium-sized businesses could be sold to the workers who help build them. For many years, worker ownership enjoyed the support of both Republicans and Democrats. As Ronald Reagan said in 1987, I can't help but believe that in the future we'll see in the United States and throughout the Western world an increasing trend toward the next logical step, employee ownership. It is a path that befits a free people. Real tax reform. For the past 40 years, Wall Street banks, large profitable corporations, and the billionaire class have rigged the tax code to redistribute wealth and income to the richest and most powerful in this country. At a time of massive wealth and income inequality, when major corporation after major corporation pays nothing in federal income taxes and many CEOs enjoy an effective tax rate that is lower than their secretaries, we need progressive income tax reform based on the ability to pay. On December 10, 2010, I spoke on the floor of the Senate for 8.5 hours. Some called it a filibuster. Others said it was just a very long speech. It doesn't really matter. The reason I took to the Senate floor for such a long period of time was to express outrage at the proposed 2-year extension of the Bush tax breaks for the top 2%. I thought it was profoundly unfair, economically unwise, and politically wrong to provide hundreds of billions in additional tax breaks to the wealthiest people in this country, especially while the overwhelming majority of Americans were still suffering through the Great Recession. Almost every Republican and far too many Democrats claimed that if the Bush tax breaks for the wealthy expired, the economy would suffer and unemployment would increase. After decades of evidence that unequivocally refuted trickle-down economics, the Republican establishment was just not giving up. When the super wealthy get more tax breaks, they don't spend more. They don't invest more in the economy. They don't create more jobs. They just look for new ways to reduce their remaining taxes. The Bush tax breaks were in place for more than a decade, and they did not create a single new private sector job. In fact, under the 8 years of President Bush, the private sector lost nearly 500,000 jobs and the deficit exploded. On the other hand, in 1993, when President Bill Clinton increased taxes on the top 2% and used that revenue to reinvest in America and reduce the deficit, more than 22 million jobs were created, and we had a $236 billion budget surplus. Had Congress let the Bush tax cuts expire in 2010, the top marginal income tax rate would have gone back to 39.6%, where it was when President Clinton was in office. That is not very high for someone earning millions of dollars a year, in my opinion. But apparently, it would have been too big a sacrifice for the people on top, despite the great wealth and political power they already had. So the tax cuts stayed in place. A $186 billion gift to the top 2%. The bill that I was filibustering also extended the 15% rate for capital gains and dividends, which meant we would continue to tax income from passive investments at a lower rate than we tax work. And that meant some millionaires and billionaires could continue paying a lower tax rate than firefighters, nurses, and teachers. As recently as 1978, the maximum capital gains rate was almost 50%, but that was steadily reduced over the next 15 years until George W. Bush pushed through the 15% rate in 2003. Extending that rate was another gift to the wealthy. This one priced at $53 billion. The bill reduced the estate tax to 35% and raised the minimum inheritance to which it was applied to $5 million, a gift to the top 0.2%. As recently as the 1990s, the estate tax was 55% and applied to all estates worth more than $1 million. Bush actually succeeded in eliminating the estate tax entirely for a year, but he was unable to keep the income inequality clock turned back to pre-1916 when there was no tax on inheritance, no matter how big the estate. The wealthy had to settle for reduced rates and a 5-fold increase in the minimum amount before the tax kicks in, a $68 billion tax break for the economic elite. To this day, I still cannot believe that Congress's response to the worst economic crisis since the 1930s was more tax cuts for the wealthy. In December 2010, millions of middle-class Americans who had lost their jobs were still searching for work, millions had lost their homes to foreclosure, and many had become homeless, including tens of thousands of veterans, men and women who served in uniform to defend this country. A growing number of children across the country were going hungry, and many seniors couldn't afford the prescription drugs they needed. But pass more tax cuts for the wealthy was exactly what Congress did, despite my protestations on the Senate floor and my best efforts to rally the American people. At the time, I predicted that as soon as the wealthy got their tax cuts, Republicans and many Democrats would flip a switch and start yammering on about the urgent need to reduce the deficit. Do you think they even once suggested raising more revenue to balance the budget? Of course not. They demanded budget cuts. That's right, deep budget cuts in the middle of a recession to reduce a deficit that had grown out of control because George W. Bush gave the wealthiest people in this country massive tax cuts while waging disastrous and costly wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Sure enough, the budget cuts went through. Over the next decade, Congress cut trillions of dollars from education, health care, and vitally important programs that help the children, the elderly, the sick, and the poor. In the past decade, how many times have you heard the refrain, "America is broke"? How many times have we heard politicians say that they would like to expand Social Security, provide health care to all, or make college affordable, but those goals are just not feasible when we have a $19.4 trillion national debt? Baloney. The establishment wants you to believe America is broke. Indeed, they need you to believe America is broke. But in reality, we are the richest country in the world. And we are richer than at any other time in history. The U.S. has a record-breaking $88 trillion in total wealth, twice the amount of just 15 years ago, and almost four times greater than the next wealthiest country. And yet every year, the federal budget gets squeezed more and more, and the deficit grows. The problem is not that we're broke. The problem is that way too much of that extraordinary wealth is owned by the top 1% who, instead of paying their fair share in taxes, have been receiving huge tax breaks for years. If we tax the wealthy in a progressive manner, we could begin to address the most urgent needs facing our country, but we don't. According to Citizens for Tax Justice, the richest 1% of Americans who took in an astounding 21.6% of all income in the U.S. last year paid just 23.6% of all federal, state, and local taxes. That's not the kind of tax system we need in America. It's not just the marginal tax rates that benefit the rich, it's also the loopholes. As Warren Buffett, the multi-billionaire investor, has often reminded us, he pays a lower effective tax rate than his own secretary. This is because capital gains and dividends are, quite incredibly, taxed at a lower rate than wages and salaries. And when there is the carried interest loophole, a tax break that allows Wall Street hedge fund managers to treat most of their earnings as long-term capital gains instead of payments for services rendered, although it makes no rational sense, this loophole cuts the tax rate in half for a small group of incredibly wealthy people, costing the U.S. Treasury as much as $180 billion over a 10-year period. Add in a whole slew of other credits and deductions, that advantage the wealthy and a billionaire hedge fund manager can pay a lower effective tax rate than a truck driver, teacher, or nurse. The old adage, it takes money to make money, is alive and well. The tax code is helping the very rich get insanely richer, while the middle class is disappearing and the poor are getting poorer. It is the Robin Hood principle in reverse. In my view, we've got to send a message to the billionaire class. You can't have it all. You can't get huge tax breaks while children in this country go hungry. You can't continue getting tax breaks by shipping American jobs to China. You can't hide your profits in the Cayman Islands and other tax havens while there are massive unmet needs in every corner of this nation. Your greed has got to end. You cannot take advantage of all the benefits of America if you refuse to accept your responsibilities as Americans. We need a tax system that is fair and progressive. The good news is that the overwhelming majority of Americans agree. A June 2016 survey by the Brookings Institution and the Public Religion Research Institute found that almost 70% of Americans support increasing taxes for people earning $250,000 or more per year. And what should send shivers down the spine of the billionaire class is that 54% of Republicans agree. Over the last 4 years, the survey noted, there has been a sea change in opinion among Republicans with regard to taxing the wealthy, noting an astounding 18-point increase in Republican support for increasing taxes on the rich just since 2012. This is remarkable, and it shows that the American people are catching on to how unfair the tax system is. And the Brookings survey was not an outlier. An April 2016 Gallup poll found 61% of Americans believe upper-income individuals pay too little in taxes, and to the conservative pundits who insist redistributing wealth is fundamentally un-American, the American people respectfully disagree, 52% believing that our government should redistribute wealth by heavy taxes on the rich. Corporate taxes. According to conservative groups like the Heritage Foundation, Cato Institute, and U.S. Chamber of Commerce, and their allies in Congress, corporations in the United States are the highest taxed in the world. That is a lie. Yes, technically the top statutory corporate income tax rate of 35% is the third highest, but in reality, most corporations don't pay anywhere close to the statutory rate. An April 2016 Government Accountability Office study found that large corporations actually pay just 14% of their profits in federal income taxes from 2008 to 2012. Not 35%, but 14%. And rather incredibly, one of every five large profitable corporations paid no federal income taxes at all in 2012, not 35%, but 0%. The reality is that for decades, corporations have been paying a smaller and smaller share of overall federal tax revenues. In 1952, corporate income taxes accounted for 32% of all federal revenue. By 2015, that number had been reduced by two-thirds to just 10.6%. In other words, a much greater share of paying for the basic government services the American people enjoy and demand, national defense, education, healthcare, the social safety net, caring for our veterans, running the national parks, and so much more, falls on the backs of working families instead of profitable corporations. And yet, according to a March 2016 article in The Economist, U.S. corporate profits are at all-time highs. How can that be? It should come as no surprise that just as our tax code benefits wealthy individuals, it also benefits some of the largest and most profitable corporations in the world, with a myriad of tax breaks, deductions, credits, and tax avoidance loopholes. Our tax code has essentially legalized tax dodging for large corporations. Take, for example, legal tax avoidance schemes like stashing cash in offshore tax havens. The Cayman Islands and Bermuda are two of the favorite countries for corporations to stash their cash, since they have secretive banking laws and no corporate taxes at all. None. And all you need to do is set up a post office box in one of those countries, and voila! You now have a foreign company with no tax liabilities. The practice has become so absurd that a single five-story office building in the Cayman Islands is now the official legal home to more than 18,000 corporations. Incredibly, this one tax avoidance scheme alone allows corporations to avoid paying more than $100 billion in U.S. taxes each and every year. These companies benefit in innumerable ways from being based in America by using taxpayer-funded infrastructure, accessing the most highly trained and productive workforce in the world, using numerous government services and sometimes grants and contracts, and so much more. They're proud to be American companies, that is, until it's time to pay their fair share of taxes. And some of the worst offenders are the big Wall Street banks. After the greed, recklessness, and illegal behavior on Wall Street drove this country into the deepest recession since the 1930s, the largest banks in the United States took every advantage of being American. They loved America and everything that taxpayers could do for them. In 2008, Congress passed a $700 billion bailout paid for by American taxpayers, and the Federal Reserve gave the financial institutions $16 trillion in virtually zero interest loans, America. What a great country! But just 2 years later, as soon as these behemoths started making record-breaking profits again, they suddenly lost their love for their native country. At a time when the nation was suffering from a huge deficit, largely created by the recession that Wall Street caused, the major financial institutions did everything they could to avoid paying taxes by, among other things, establishing shell corporations in the Cayman Islands and other tax havens. In 2010, Bank of America set up more than 200 subsidiaries in the Caymans. Not only did it pay no federal income taxes that year, it received a tax refund for $1.9 billion. Apparently, Bank of America thought stiffing the American Treasury was the appropriate way to thank taxpayers for the more than $1.3 trillion it received through the bailout and the Federal Reserve. In 2013, J.P. Morgan Chase made a profit of more than $17 billion, but received a $1.3 billion tax refund thanks in large part to its four subsidiaries incorporated in offshore tax havens. I guess J.P. Morgan Chase thought that was the right thing to do after receiving a bailout of more than $400 billion. In 2013, Citigroup made a profit of more than $6.3 billion, but received a tax refund of $260 million. During the financial crisis, Citigroup received $2.5 trillion in financial assistance from the Federal Reserve that kept it from going under. And in 2014, Goldman Sachs had 20 subsidiaries in offshore tax havens, which allowed it to avoid an estimated $4.6 billion in U.S. taxes. What a nice way to say thanks for the more than $800 billion in assistance Goldman received during the financial crisis. On and on it goes. Wall Street banks and large companies love America when they need corporate welfare, but when it comes to paying American taxes, they want nothing to do with this country. And let's be clear, offshore tax abuse is not just limited to Wall Street. Pharmaceutical companies like Eli Lilly and Pfizer have fought to make it illegal for the American people to get cheaper prescription drugs from Canada and Europe, but during tax season, Eli Lilly and Pfizer shift drug patents and profits to the Netherlands and other offshore tax havens to avoid paying U.S. taxes. One of the most popular tax avoidance schemes that the pharmaceutical industry has exploited is called a corporate inversion, which allows American corporations to merge with foreign companies in low-tax countries to save billions in taxes. Some of the highest profile inversions attempted or successful have involved pharmaceutical companies like Pfizer, Eli Lilly, Mylan, the manufacturer of the EpiPen, Amgen, Merck, Actavis, Abbvie, and others. These are all U.S. companies, but many have more than 80% of their cash overseas sheltered from U.S. taxes. Gilead Sciences is perhaps the most egregious example of a pharmaceutical company stiffing American taxpayers. Here is the backstory. In 2014, Gilead came out with a game-changing new drug to treat the chronic liver disease hepatitis C. If left untreated, the disease can end in what one nurse practitioner called some of the worst deaths I've ever seen. You die not knowing who you are. Your belly looks 12 months pregnant, you're malnourished, and you're bleeding to death. Fortunately, the new drug, Sovaldi, works extraordinarily well, is successful nearly 90% of the time, and has few side effects. Like many new drugs, Sovaldi was developed with grants from the National Institutes of Health to help spur innovation and develop important breakthrough medicines and therapies. Gilead bought the small company that discovered the drug for $11 billion and got fast-track approval from the FDA in December 2013 to begin selling it. And that's where the feel-good part of the story ends. Gilead set the price for Sovaldi at $1,000 per pill, or $84,000 for a 12-week course of treatment, even though analysts believe it could cost Gilead as little as $100 to manufacture the 84 pills. Public and private insurers spent more on Sovaldi in 2014, its first year on the market, than on any other prescription drug. But the astronomical cost put it out of reach for many Hep C patients who are disproportionately low income or veterans. The budgets of Medicare Part D and Medicaid strained under the costs, and the VA struggled to provide it to all veterans with the disease. According to a July 2016 Americans for Tax Fairness report, Gilead made back its initial investment in less than a year. The company rewarded its CEO with $200 million in compensation, which is, even at Sovaldi's insanely inflated price, enough to treat 3,000 Hep C patients. In 2 years, Gilead's profits soared more than fivefold, from $4 billion in 2013 to $22 billion in 2015. Yet its overall effective tax rate plummeted from 27.3% to 16.4% over the same period. How did that company do that? First, Gilead transferred some of its physical assets to Ireland, and then, with a completely straight face, it claimed that while two-thirds of its revenues were generated in America, only one-third of its profits were made here, which allowed Gilead to dodge $9.7 billion in U.S. taxes last year alone. Wonder what that $9.7 billion in lost tax revenue would mean for the United States? According to Americans for Tax Fairness, it would double to 2 million the number of low-income kids and pregnant women served in a year by the highly successful Head Start program, or help 7 million households stay warm over three winters through the LIHEAP program, or ensure 1.5 years of nutritional assistance to 8.5 million participants in the Women, Infants, and Children, WIC program. Remember, American taxpayers helped pay for the initial research. They paid for the government agencies that granted market exclusivity and that approved Sovaldi on an expedited basis. They subsidized its purchase for countless seniors, low-income patients, and veterans. American taxpayers helped make Gilead the most profitable Fortune 500 prescription drug company in the world in 2015, making over $18 billion in profits, and Gilead's way of thanking the taxpayer is by stiffing the national treasury of nearly $10 billion. High-tech companies are also very good at gaming the tax system. And no one is better at it than Apple. Apple created some of the most iconic and popular computers, handheld devices, and software with American know-how, and all of the benefits and synergies of being located in Silicon Valley. But when it comes time to manufacturing its products, Apple turns to China to avoid paying American wages. And when Apple shifts most of its profits to Ireland, Luxembourg, the British Virgin Islands, and other tax havens to avoid paying U.S. taxes. In fact, Apple has more than $180 billion in profits offshore, more than any other American company. Without such maneuvers, Apple would owe an estimated $59 billion in federal taxes. In late August 2016, after benefiting from years of dubious tax breaks, even by tax haven standards, the European Commission ordered Ireland to collect $14.5 billion in back taxes from Apple. Just 2 days later, CEO Tim Cook said Apple might be ready to move the company's money again, maybe even to the United States. "We provisioned several billion dollars for the U.S. for payment as soon as we repatriate it. And right now, I would forecast the repatriation to occur next year," Cook said. Of course, several billion is a lot less than the $59 billion Apple owes the American people, which is why you can bet Cook has a small army of lobbyists furiously working the halls of Congress to pass some sort of tax holiday. Over and over, profitable corporations take advantage of the many benefits of being American companies. But when it comes time to pay their taxes, they suddenly abandon their allegiances to this country. A 2008 Government Accountability Office report found 83 of the Fortune 100 companies use at least one offshore tax scheme to lower their taxes. And that number is undoubtedly higher today. In 2015 alone, American corporations held a total of $2.4 trillion in offshore profits in tax haven countries, deferring payment of some $700 billion in U.S. taxes. $700 billion! America is not broke. The very wealthy and hugely profitable corporations just aren't paying the taxes that, in the words of Supreme Court Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes more than a century ago, are the price we pay for a civilized society. Quite simply, the tax avoidance schemes they use rob our national coffers of the revenue we need to provide quality health care for all, care for the men and women who served in the military, make higher education affordable, allow seniors to retire in dignity, rebuild our roads and bridges, make sure no child goes to bed hungry, protect the environment, and much more. The crazy thing is that the tax code, our tax code, allows this kind of tax dodging. It is all legal. How the code got this way is no surprise. Corporations have spent billions over the years in campaign contributions and lobbying to make sure Congress creates and maintains the many loopholes they benefit from. Here's a not-so-radical idea. Instead of just listening to the rich and powerful few, maybe Congress should start listening to the majority of the American people who want a fair tax system. Ending corporate tax dodging. Corporate tax reform must start by preventing profitable companies from sheltering profits in tax haven countries like the Cayman Islands. In 2015, I introduced legislation with Senator Brian Schatz of Hawaii and Representative Jan Schakowsky of Illinois to do just that. The Corporate Tax Dodging Prevention Act would end the loophole that allows corporations to defer paying taxes on overseas profits. Instead, it would require corporations to pay U.S. taxes on offshore profits as they are earned. This bill would take away the tax incentives for corporations to shift profits and move jobs and factories offshore by taxing their profits no matter where they are generated. American corporations would continue to get a credit against their U.S. tax liability for foreign taxes they pay, but they would have to pay the federal government the difference between the foreign rate and the U.S. rate. The bill would also prevent corporations from establishing completely fictitious foreign shell companies to avoid paying U.S. taxes. True, this may have a deleterious effect on that building on Grand Cayman Island with its more than 18,000 corporate residents, but it would go a long way toward collecting the $100 billion a year in taxes that are lost when companies stash profits overseas. Further, the legislation would eliminate a tax loophole that allows big oil companies, some of the most profitable corporations ever, to pay less in taxes. Currently, oil companies can treat royalty payments to foreign governments as if they are foreign tax payments, deducting $1 in U.S. taxes owed for every dollar paid in royalties. That's crazy! Oil royalties are not taxes. They are a cost of doing business. My bill would close this loophole, which is really just an American taxpayer subsidy for big oil. The legislation will raise an estimated $1 trillion in new revenue over the next decade. Revenue that I think we should use to create 13 million new jobs, rebuilding our roads and bridges, public transportation and intercity rail, drinking and wastewater facilities, and addressing